You're listening to a podcast from the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace.
Good afternoon. Welcome to the Carnegie Endowment. I'm Chris Bosek, part of the Middle East program here at Carnegie, and I'm very pleased to see so many people come out for what promises to be a great presentation and discussion. The topic of today, the de-radicalization and disengagement in North Africa, is a fascinating topic. I think as more and more attention is paid to counter-radicalization, disengagement, de-radicalization, it's especially important to understand how these processes are working in different parts of the world. And the our speaker, Omar Ashour, was going to speak about his research looking at Egypt, Algeria, and Libya. I'm especially excited to hear about Omar's research. He's written some fascinating articles for Middle East Journal, Journal of Conflict Studies, and Studies in Conflict and Terrorism. Omar is a lecturer in politics at the University of Exeter. And I think without much further ado, I'll ask Omar to speak.
Thank you. Thank you, Chris, and welcome, everybody. I'm going to speak today about de-radicalization, which is mostly about violence, not about democracy, so just to give this highlight. If you looked at the processes of change within armed Islamist movements or Islamist movements in general, you'll find the three processes basically taking place. One that we focus on a lot, the radicalization, usually a demand for sweeping socio-political and socio-economic changes within the society, sometimes coupled with violent or armed action. Another is about, so radicalization basically about violence. Another is about democracy, which the moderation process, acceptance of diversity within the society, putting away armed action as a resort to attain political ends. And finally, the process that I'm going to speak today at length and look at cases from Egypt, Algeria, and Libya, and that is the process of de-radicalization. De-radicalized militants can be still anti-democratic, misogynist, xenophobic, homophobic, list goes on and on. But the only change or the major change here is the abandonment and the delegitimization of violence to impose their own views. I want to distinguish about between two issues, de-radicalization processes and de-radicalization programs. Programs usually imposed from above, structured and planned by the state and imposed usually in prisons. And we have the case of Saudi Arabia, Yemen, now in Iraq and lesser so in Afghanistan, Singapore, Malaysia, Indonesia, and so on. These are usually programs targeting individuals and sometimes small factions within a larger organization in an attempt to convince them to abandon and delegitimize violence, as opposed to processes which is usually coming from an organization per se and coming usually from the leadership of a particular organization, and the attempt is to collective disengagement from violence or a collective de-radicalization that ends up taking the thousands or the hundreds or the tens of thousands that compose the organization away from the violent path. So usually programs targeting individuals, factions, processes usually targeting larger organizations. Dimensions of DRAD, you'll find several dimensions, three of them. The ideological, the behavioral one first, which is usually a commitment to abandoning violence after a while engaging in armed action. An ideological dimension, which has to do mainly with the theological / ideological delegitimization of violence. And finally, the most challenging, the organizational dimension, which has to do with dismantling the armed units of the organization in question without splits, without mutiny, without factionalization, and most importantly, without taking out the leadership. So that's the challenge. Organizational, usually, the organizational dimension usually focuses on DDR tactics, disarmament, demobilization, and reintegration in the society at a later stage. When all these dimensions are met, I usually call it comprehensive de-radicalization, so meeting the behavioral, ideological, and organizational part. And in Egypt, we have a couple of examples. The old one that is quite understudied, that of the armed wings of the Muslim Brothers, which went through a very complex de-rad process, ending up by 1973, where they abandoned violence, dismantled the armed units, and published a book, Du'a ala Quda, or Preachers Not Judges, that pretty much countered the Takfiri ideology of some of the members of the of this group. And the more recent group, the Islamic Group of Egypt, which started a unilateral ceasefire in 1997, ended up being a comprehensive de-rad process by 2002, and we'll speak at length about it in a bit. Usually, the substantive type of de-rad involves ideology and involves behavior, but does not involve the organizational dimension, meaning that leadership of an organization would declare that it won't take up armed action, and it would delegitimize violence against the state and the society, but at the same time fails to convince factions within the organization to dismantle. And at this point, we're talking about al-Jihad in Egypt and the Libyan fighting group or Islamist fighting group in Libya. And then you have the a third type, which is pragmatic, pretty much behavioral and organizational, but without ideology. You don't delegitimize violence on ideological or theological levels. But you just dismantle your arm wing and declare that you're not going to take up arms against the state. And we have the most famous case, the Islamic Salvation Army in Algeria. And then there are many cases of DRAD's attempts and failures. The leadership would try to dismantle the organization and try to abandon violence, but fails to do so. Muslim Brothers in Egypt, one of the main cases. In 1951, between 51 and 53, and then the GIA and the GSPC in Algeria, which again we're going to talk a little bit about in a bit. It's just a schedule of summarizing DRAD attempts in the three countries in question today, Egypt, Libya, and Algeria. With the Muslim Brothers back in 1951, when Hassan al-Hudaybi took over, tried to dismantle the armed unit of the group, the special apparatus at this point, and failed by 1953. And the failure included the assassination of the appointed leader of the special apparatus, the one appointed by al-Hudaybi. So a couple of failures, another failure in 64, between 64 and 65, an attempt to dismantle an up-and-coming armed wing, and ended up in another failure. And finally, between 69 and 73, a more successful attempt at de-radicalization. The IG case, as I mentioned, most of the dynamics of this process took place between 1997 and 2002, ended up impressively quite successful with almost no splits, no factionalization, which is it's quite unusual in this type of processes. And then the case of al-Jihad, which followed up due to factionalizations and other internal dynamics, which I'm going to speak quickly about later, ended up in a stalemate in 2008, with some factions upholding violence and others abandoning it and delegitimizing it. And then you have the Algerian cases, most successfully the AIS case, more or less a pragmatic case of DRAD. Without an ideological delegitimization process, and the interesting thing about it, usually pragmatic de-radicalization ends up quicker than comprehensive de-radicalization, because once you get into the ideology and the theology, things get more controversial and de-rad gets delayed. So that was a quick process. In 3 years, they were able to dismantle their own organization. But now there are problems with reintegration, which we're going to, again, I'm going to speak about in a bit. GIA and GSPC attempts, mostly by factions, not by the leadership of the two organizations, ending up in failure. In the GSPC case, some factions, and the GIA case as well, some factions actually put down arms and abandoned violence, but the organization as a whole, the GIA, was destroyed by 2005. the GSPC morphed into the Al-Qaeda in Maghreb currently. Finally, the fighting Islamic group in Libya, which again we're going to speak about a bit, one attempt by the leadership in 2006 and currently ongoing. In March 2009, some releases were done by the Libyan government, and the talks are still ongoing about whether they should produce an ideological delegitimization of violence in exchange of what. So the negotiations are still going on. Now the central puzzle is, why do they do so, and how do they do so? Why do they change their ideologies and objectives? And how or what are the conditions for successful de-radicalization, again, without splintering, without factionalizing? And this is what I'll try to answer a bit today. These are the four factors that are usually at play here, at play in de-radicalization processes, at least the successful ones. First, the leadership, if it took a stance, a united, cohesive, usually charismatic leadership, once it takes a stance against violence, this becomes quite helpful, but there are reasons for the change of heart within the leadership. Usually the spiritual, between quotation, meaning the religious or the theological leadership, they are quite successful at taking away the legitimacy or giving the legitimacy for the DRAD process, and this explains, in the IG case, you know, there was vying for the approval of Sheikh Omar Abdurrahman, a theologian who led the group for a while and now imprisoned here. Back in the 90s, the factions that approved DRAD wanted his approval. The factions that wanted to continue the violent path also wanted his approval. One of the main reasons, as we know now from a lengthy interview with Hassan Hattab, the head of the GSPC, the founder and the head of the GSPC, one of the main reasons for the failure of the GSPC was that the head of the Lajna Sharia, the legitimate committee, which is the committee that is responsible for issuing fatwas within the GSPC, refused the process, refused the reconciliation process, and took with him many of the grassroots. So, in this sense, the spiritual versus the organizational leadership, there is a lot of weight for the spiritual leadership in that sense. Also, when the leadership produces ideological backing, this usually acts as a hurdle to reversals in the process, because the legitimacy is already taken away from violence. And if a group decided to go back into violence, there will be a lot of books that says, you know, we abandoned this, and this is why we abandoned it. And you'll probably, if you take it up again, you'll probably burn in hell, between quotations. So, state repression is another variable that is quite a play in DRAD processes. And state repression has multiple effects. It does radicalize. There's a consensus on the studies on political violence and radicalization that state repression can have a negative impact on the behavior of specific organizations, and obviously the Islamic group in Egypt is a famous case, the case of the FIS, the Islamic Salvation Front in Algeria, repression leading to direct political violence. And yesterday there was a conference here in Pakistan that showed some statistics on how the incredible increase in suicide bombing, I think they said 300%, post the events in the Red Mosque. So that's one effect of repression. There's another effect which has to do with de-radicalization. When a leadership attempts to de-radicalize a particular organization, what happens is that if the repression is ongoing, then usually that's a hurdle to de-radicalization. The third case is when actually de-radicalization happens. What leads the leadership to change its mind on violence is usually the repression from the state. So you would hear people like Mdouh Ali Youssef, one of the armed wing leaders of the Islamic group, would say, frankly, we thought that God is not on our side anymore. And because what happened to us in the 90s and the 80s was horrible and we couldn't stand it anymore, and therefore we decided to change this. And you'll see this similar type of repressions within the Algerian case as well, especially the massacres that occurred in the 1990s, the mid-1990s, and led the AIS to say, that's it, we better put down arms at this point. Interaction happens between the leadership and its own followers. This is what I call internal interaction. And the leadership and the other being non-Islamist, mainly seculars, liberals, human rights activists. We have Dr. Saadi Ibrahim here, one of the pioneers in this external interaction with the leadership, and convince it that what they're actually doing is illegitimate on several levels. And finally, the selective inducements. And selective inducements can be anything, starting from seizing torture in prisons all the way to a power-sharing formula in the government. We had the case of the power-sharing formula in Tajikistan, and releases, compensation, pensions in cases in Egypt, Algeria, Libya, and Saudi Arabia, and so on. Here leadership matters. This is a picture of, I think it's Osama Hafiz from the Consultative Council of the Islamic Group, with during one of these de-radicalization conferences, attempting to convince the grassroots to put down arms and abandon violence, you had a long line of followers kissing his hands one by one. And when I saw this, I was thinking, I mean, that was titanically bad leadership on their part. I mean, they dragged their followers into prisons, and still their followers are quite attached to them. And this one of the reasons, what explains really the collective derad that happened with the IG and lack of splits and mutinies within the organization. Types of state repression interactions. And finally, that's a quote from Karam Zuhdi in 2002 in Al-Musawar newspaper, basically saying that the armed wings of the group will be paid pensions. So this is one of the selective inducements. How much time do I have before? Five minutes. Okay. Plenty of time.
Yeah.
Okay. I have a lot to go through. So, the IG case, I'm just gonna go quickly through case by case. There were several attempts basically to de-radicalize the group in the 80s and the early 90s, and they weren't successful. Some by Al-Azhar as an institution to take away the legitimacy from political violence. Some were suicidal by multiple groups, intellectuals, human rights activists. A program called the Repentance Program, Al-Tawbah Program, imposed in the prison to reward whoever abandons violence and declares allegiance to the state. And more oppression for the ones who didn't. All this failed. And then one factional attempt by one of the, I think it was the leader of Aswan in the Islamic group, Khalid Mustafa, who declared a ceasefire on his own in 1996, and it was not accepted by the leadership. So all these were attempts to de-radicalize via either bypassing the leadership or attempts that the leadership did not approve. And that was the case until 96. There was the role also of the regime between 89 and 98, mostly exclusion, delegitimization of the group exclusively as a terrorist group, and therefore the official stance was we don't negotiate with terrorists. July 1997, things changed with the Initiative for Ceasing Violence, declared by one of the group by the historical leadership via one of their followers in a military tribunal, which led to a couple of responses by the state. They weren't interested. They actually stopped the any communications between the group and the rest of the world. By the society, there wasn't much interest except in maybe a few civil society organizations, and some of the factions within the IG rejected the ICV, the Initiative for Ceasing Violence. 9/11 changed that. There was The state basically changed its policies for specific reasons. I don't have time to get into them right now. But what happened is basically there was a lot of internal interaction. So the state sponsored the process of dialogue between the leadership and its grassroots inside the prison, and a process of dialogue between the leadership and its followers outside of Egypt. And that was quite successful. In the end, all the factions, except with exception of two mid-ranking commanders, upheld the process. So far, between 2002 and now 2009, you have around 25 volumes that support the delegitimization process of violence produced by the historical leadership of the IG, which actually, you know, part of them engaged in assassinating the president of Egypt back in 81. And you know, a couple of these. This is one of the latest books, the Mandatory Advice for the Leadership of Al-Qaeda. And two others, books here criticizing Al-Qaeda, the strategy and the bombings of Al-Qaeda, the dangers and the mistakes in the Riyadh bombings. And most notably here, if you saw, the Islamic group usually had a sword, so the Mus'haf, the Quran, and the sun, and then the sword. Now they removed the sword. So that's the new transformation. In the case of Al-Jihad, the problem with Al-Jihad is that it has, that's a different structure. The IG started as a student organization and then later on had a paramilitary wing, but had also other activities, missionary activities, Amr Ma'ruf, preventing vice and promoting virtue activities and so on, in quotations. Al-Jihad was mostly a paramilitary organization, secretive, elitist, and their aim was to topple the regime via a coup, preferably, because it's the shortest way. And their structure was, you had leaders of cells, basically, connected to each other by someone who's outside of Egypt. So once these cells fall apart, all their leaders would think of each other as equal. So if somebody declared or supported de-radicalization, the others would simply say, you're not our leader. And this is what happened in 97. Some of them supported the ICV of the Islamic group, but the rest did not, or the overwhelming majority did not. This changed in 2007 when this man, Sayyid Imam al-Sharif, who pretty much some consider him the most important ideologue of jihadism after Sayyid Qutb, he was captured in Yemen in 2004, rendered to Egypt rendered to Egypt then, and disappeared for a while. 2007, he started a DRAD process, and now you have somebody who's high up in the ranks. Produced a couple of books that were countered by Al-Zawahiri, who wrote the Vindication in response to the document for guiding jihad by Al-Sharif. And then Al-Sharif replied back by The Uncovering, another book. And then Hani Sibai in London, one of formerly Al-Jihad commanders, replied with a fourth book to counter what Al-Sharif has said in the Uncovering. And then there was also various letters. The problem with the latest one, the Uncovering, is that Al-Sharif made it quite personal. Not more or less a new ideology or an alternative to the old ideology, but more of a personal problem with him, between him and Al-Zawahiri, which was quite easily to counter in the in what the pro or the militants thought the right way to follow. Currently, there are a few problems with the Al-Jihad, DRAD, or, you know, stalled since 2008, as I mentioned, but there are a few problems with the process. One of them is that the hidden imam, or Al-Sharif, he was hidden for a reason. He is quite socially awkward, not media savvy. Plainly mentioned that if you did not follow the fatwas I issued, you're in war with God and the Prophet. So this kind of rhetoric can be easily countered by the jihadists who are, you know, affiliated with Al-Qaeda and Al-Jihad. So he wasn't advised well, and I personally think he should have went through a psychological rehab process before exposing him to the media. There is issues also with factionalism in prison and factionalism abroad. Some of the leaders of, or former leaders or mid-rank commanders in al-Jihad are now senior commanders in al-Qaeda, most notably the Mustafa Abu Yazid in Afghanistan and Yusuf Dardiri in Iraq. Those, again, have their own views about de-radicalization, not necessarily supportive, but also the ones who are in prison are not necessarily supportive as well. So this is like quite just a map of the jihad factions within Egyptian prisons, not all of them. Because there's no time, I'll just go very quickly with the numbers. You'll find the majority actually supportive of DRAD. Around 300, 350 are not supportive. There are three or four prisons that are not included in this table, and if you can't find data about them, this is my experience suggests, they're probably saying things that the state don't want them to say. So in this sense, they're probably opposing de-radicalization, not supportive of that. Okay, should I move on to Algeria? Or okay. Algeria, we have quite a different scenario here. We had two major organizations, the IS and the GIA, started because of the same crisis pretty much, ended up in very different direction. One de-radicalized, dismantled, and trying to reintegrate, although there's a lot of problems with that. And the others, the other one, the GIA, ended up with a big split in 98 to become the ones who split became what we know now as the GSPC, Salafi Group for Preaching and Combat. Leading to, and after that, by 2005, the GIA was destroyed in 2005. And what was left either joined the reconciliation process or joined the AQM, what we know now as the AQM. Now, the question is why? And the why, usually the easiest answer is like ideology matters. The IS was a self-declared arm wing of a political party that really did not believe in taking up, that believed in democracy and believed in compromise to a certain degree. Electoral democracy is what I'm talking about, not liberal democracy. And wanted a solution for this, whereas the GIA from the beginning, they were quite happy to continue the fight until the end. They did not believe in democracy. And they thought that this whole thing is, this whole democratic process is just a simple process. But that's not the answer, because if you looked at who supported DRAD and who opposed it, you'll find the believers in democracy, some of them supporting armed action against the state, and the opposite is true. Some who do not believe really in democracy have supported de-radicalization. So ideology was not really a factor here. What you had is this man, Madani Mirzaq, the national emir of the AIS, and this man, General Ismail Amari, started negotiations just to tell each other that within each faction, within each warring camp, there is a faction that is really interested in de-radicalization. And the breakthrough came when General Amari here went to the mountains of Bani Khattab in Jaijil, met with Mizraq, met unarmed, and the process started then. That was July, that was, the meeting was June 1997. October 1997, Mizraq declares a unilateral ceasefire, which became later on the basis of the reconciliation and de-radicalization process. There was a lot going on at this period in the mid-90s, most notably the massacres, which when you put it on statistics, you'll find them targeting mainly districts that supported the FIS back before during the elections and had a lot of the AIS supporters. So whether it was the GIA massacring the relatives of the rivals, which is quite possible at this point, or as some accuse, some of the military factions were doing that as a counterinsurgency tactic to pressure the AIS and other insurgents to put down arms. In all cases, the statement now is the massacres actually led the AIS to put down arms. There were a lot of interactions, mainly with seculars. The AIS was the only group that supported the Rome Accords, the elite compromise, as we like to say in poli-sci, when multiple factions within the Algerian political spectrum met in Rome in 1995 and called for reconciliation and back to the democratic process. When it comes to inducements, there's quite a lot of problems with the process. The political prisoner issue was resolved with the AIS and with the FIS supporters. Disappearances unresolved. We have around 20,000 disappearances during this period of the Algerian civil war. The state blames, a committee appointed by the President Bouteflika blames more than 6,000 disappearances on the security services, but the rest are unaccounted for, so you can do the math. There was a couple of other issues that has to do with social reintegration, basically the employment, the compensations for de-radicalized militants or people who are detained as terrorism suspects, and there is like 500,000 of them during that crisis who were detained and then released. And the issue of political rights, because the AIS and others claim that we put down arms for a reason to be normal citizens, and if we cannot form a party or if we cannot vote, then we really don't have to, then we're not really buying into this. I'll skip this one. Talk a little bit quickly about the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group, because I have only 5 minutes. Basically, it's a group that was more or less formed in Afghanistan with a little bit of roots in Libya. Organizational structure very similar to Al-Jihad, focus Egyptian Al-Jihad, this is what I mean. Focus, secretive, it was formed in 1990. It only came out publicly in 1995 because one of their members just did something without going back to leadership. He made an operation to save one of his friends from a hospital, an imprisoned friend from a hospital. And that blew their cover, and they became now, they declared that they do exist. But before that, they were saying, we do not exist. Between 95 and 2000, or 1998, to be more accurate, multiple clashes with the Libyan security forces, mostly around the Derna in the east of Libya. By the 2000, there was a process of reorientation where the leadership specifically was thinking we should stop any operations in Libya until we regather again and see what's going on. And what happened is that most of the leadership went to Afghanistan and decided to live happily under the Taliban. That did not work well in September or post 9/11. Some of the leaders of the fighting Islamic group decided to stay in Afghanistan and fight the Americans, those were the minority, and the rest decided to flee somewhere else until the head of the Libyan fighting group, Abu Abdullah Sadiq, was arrested in Thailand in 2004, and Abu Munzir Saidi, the ones who issue fatwas for them, was arrested in Hong Kong in 2004 as well, rendered to Libya. By 2006, they were thinking inside the prison to start a process, watching Egypt, watching what was going on with the Islamic group there, decided to start a process of de-radicalization. And it went through several hurdles and problems, mainly because most of the leaders who are still in Afghanistan fighting with Al-Qaeda mainly decided to not to support this process until their leader, Abu Layth, was killed in Afghanistan. And once he was killed, the process started to be up and running again. Now there has been several releases in March 2009 of several affiliates from the Libyan fighting group, and the process is ongoing. I'm just going to sum up quickly with this pattern. There's this pattern in all of these cases. State repression plus interaction with the others, moderate Islamists, seculars, human rights activists, and so on, usually convince a charismatic or a united leadership to issue a ceasefire. or issue a behavioral de-radicalization process and initiate one. And this process is usually reinforced by communication or interaction between the leadership and its grassroots, reinforced by selective inducements usually from the state. And this was replicated in a couple of other places as processes. And then we have now the programs that we I've mentioned in the beginning, and Chris can say a lot about in his work on Saudi Arabia. I'm going to stop here now, and maybe during the Q&A period we can speak a bit about, or should I go with the future of DRED? Yeah, we can do this with, yeah. Perfect. Thank you.
Omar, thank you very much for a really fascinating overview of what's going on in North Africa in these three different case studies. I think it's especially important to hear about the research you're doing, you know, for lots of different reasons, you know, especially as there's an increased, I guess, acceptance of de-radicalization or disengagement from violence, that people, you know, aren't always violent. But as this discussion continues, it's really critical that we get research that actually explains how these things work in different parts of the world. And I think, you know, some of the points that you really highlighted about these programs being about disengagement from violence or abandonment of violence and not necessarily about moderating deeply held beliefs is really important. I'm sure that'll get drawn out in the Q&A. I also think this notion of looking at these different efforts in terms of either programs or processes is really helpful. I think it kind of explains why different groups leave violence behind and why other groups don't in certain cases. I think, you know, one of the points I felt that you brought up over and over again was prison conditions and how prison conditions, when they improve, what leads from that. And it seems like this is one of the great understudied stories in the Middle East about what's going on in prisons in the Arab world. I think the framework that you laid out, you know, about state repression, inducements and incentives, and the importance of leadership, I think is really helpful for us when we're looking at why these things work in certain parts of the world and not others. So I really appreciate, you know, you coming to share your research with us today. We're going to next hear from Lieutenant Colonel Ruda Fatala, who is joining us from the Secretary of Defense's office, where he works on terrorism and counterterrorism issues. And he's going to speak 5-10 minutes, I think, about terrorism in the region, in North Africa and in the Sahel, and about counterterrorism and threat perceptions. Again, I'd just like to remind everybody that Lieutenant Colonel Atala's remarks are not for attribution and off the record. Rudy, please.
Yeah. No, you're good. I was going to pop a map. There you go. I just popped the map up, and there we go.
All right, I'm going to keep this very brief. It's humbling, kind of being around here. A lot of 10-pound brains, and I'm normal grunt from the military talking about the threat. The way we see the threat normally from the military side, we try to assess the threat very quickly, figure out the pressure points, and go after those pressure points. I'm going to briefly talk about the way we perceive the threat shaping in North Africa and the Sahel, mainly from AQIM. And the long-term approach, what we're thinking. When AQIM, when there was a shift from GSPC to AQIM, everybody's looking at the map here, that's kind of, it's easy for us. We color code the regions that we had to deal with, and that's what we focus on. When GSPC morphed into AQIM, there was a quick restructuring within the group itself. For instance, GSPC was divided into 9 zones inside Algeria. The regrouping was back to 4 zones, 4 katibat, where the leadership was able to quickly deal with control as leaders were targeted probably by Algerians and taken out. There's basically a tit for tat between the Algerians and the AQIM leadership. The other thing they did is go outside of the borders of Algeria, making it very difficult for the Algerian government to respond. And more or less in the last year, year and a half, we've seen attacks against French tourists in Mauritania, beheading of Mauritanians, attack against the Israeli embassy, and more recently, for those who follow the news, we've got a rash of kidnappings in the Sahel region. That's a whole restructuring in an approach, and the kidnappings have made, in one case, in the case of the Austrians, got AQIM some funding that is needed. And that's very difficult for the Algerians to do anything about. And the concern is how, as this group keeps morphing itself, it's also going to probably get a boost from foreign fighter flow from North Africa that went to Iraq, now flowing back into the region and taking the capabilities of this group to a different level. Because for years, the insurgents in Iraq have been are used to fighting a force like us. Now go back into North Africa, into their countries of origin, and now that capability is taken, where it makes the dynamics a little bit more challenging for the host nations. The North African countries have capabilities to deal with the threat issues within their borders. The problem lies more or less in the Sahel region, countries like Mali, Niger, Mauritania, that don't have the resources to respond to the threat. And additionally, with internal issues, for instance, between the Malian government and the Tuaregs in the north, it makes it very challenging to respond to the threat properly. For instance, the kidnappings that occur in the Sahel, the hostages are held in that region, no man's land, that's a little bit difficult for those host nations to deal with. So that's one area of concern. The other thing that we have coming in through the Sahel that AQIM does take advantage of is the drug network that's developing from countries like Guinea-Bissau and Guinea are flowing through the Sahel region and through North Africa. We're seeing a higher influx now going into Europe. And access for these drugs going through AQIM country is being capitalized on. So that makes it, that gives AQIM the capability to get the resources they need. Also, in different parts of Africa, we have issues like Sudan, Chad, ongoing coups like Mauritania, brings in an influx of weapons flow, and that gives them access now, money, weapons, and capabilities in areas where they can work. One other thing that's a concern is, as AQ starts to reshape itself, we see the reshaping of AQIM in East Africa, Al-Qaeda cells. Then you have AQTN, the Al-Qaeda in the land of the Two Niles in Sudan. The big question mark is, are these individual groups going to start linking up? They answer to the big Al-Qaeda, but what about inside on the continent itself? Will they link up? Are there ideological differences? These are questions that we're looking at very carefully. Let's see here. One other factor that's really challenging also, when you have political problems between Morocco and Algeria over Western Sahara, it makes it a bit challenging to get those countries to work towards a solution to mitigate the threat. These are areas that we're constantly wrestling with, and the political side of the house, everybody wants to solve the Western Sahara issue, which will open up probably the door for better cooperation between Algeria and Morocco. Some people will argue that there is cooperation, and yes, there is, but it can always be better. And the last note I want to leave you with is Europe. In the case of France, for instance, a population of 50, 60 million, you have approximately 5 million, somewhere in that neighborhood, of North Africans living there. You have North Africans living in other European countries. They've been around for a long time. That network is also presents a problem because that's a network that has ties directly into the areas, into North Africa, and then also back into the foreign fighter network in Iraq and Afghanistan. This is an area where we're working closely with partner nations to try to figure out the best way to prevent the threat from increasing from there. And I'll leave you with that.
Thank you so much. You did a brilliant job of hitting on all the important points in 5 minutes, and I'm so glad that I don't have to do it now. But I think, you know, these points that you drew out about regional cooperation and undergoverned spaces is so important. We have about 25 minutes or so for questions, and what I'd like to do is, so we can get as many people involved as possible, sort of group them in bunches. So would someone like to start? Sir. There's a microphone coming, actually. If you could just please identify everyone else, identify yourself. For
yes, my name is Saaduddin Ibrahim, and I'm pleased to have heard both presentations. This is an area of interest that I had followed for quite a while. I have one question to both speakers, and that is the role of the public opinion in the process of de-radicalization. I was struck by the fact, which was not amply covered in the presentation, but probably in the written work, is whether the public opinion is tolerant or hostile to the radicals, and how, when that changes, it could also impact the process of de-radicalization. In 1997, after one of the Islamic militant groups committed the massacre in Luxor, there was a massive public opinion adverse reaction to it. And I think that has a great deal to do, at least in that case, of some of the what is described here as de-radicalization. So I just wonder if the two speakers can comment on that in other cases like Algeria, Libya, and what have you. Thank you.
Go ahead. Thank you, Saad. Well, another question?
Please. Should
we take over the question?
Sure. Ali Abu Zakouk, Libya Human and Political Development Forum. I would like to again also thank both presentations and especially the one who's Mr. Omar Ashour on the issues of those groups. And my question to you is on twofold. First of all, what are the real causes of the establishment and foundations of these organizations? And do you think that the lack of freedom, the lack of democracy, and the lack of good governance contribute to that? And since we still have those facts on the ground, it may end these groups, but it may create new groups. That's number one. Number two, is there any kind of correlation organizationally between these groups, or are they homegrown, even though they might be inspired ideologically?
My name is Hamid Lillou. I work for Center for Advanced Cultural Learning, USMC Quantico. I have two questions. First for Mr. Ashour. I know you're not here to promote the Islamist group, but do you agree that the Islamists from Turkey are more successful? And if they are, what do the Arab Islamist group are missing and why they're not successful as much as the Turkish? And the second question is for Lieutenant Colonel. Do you really believe that Al-Qaeda is really implemented in North Africa, or is it more for this jihadist group claiming to belong to these groups because of their sanguinity and because this would help them to give them more strength and credibility. Thank you very much.
I think let's start with those three. And again, Rudy's remarks are not for attribution and off the record. So.
Thank you. First, public opinion, of course, crucial. One of the reasons in the Algerian scenario is that the FIS was an elected party. It had a lot of support, and they did not lose this anymore. They did not want to lose this in the process. And in 1995, something quite interesting happened in the middle of the civil war. Madani Mirzaq, the head of the Islamic Salvation Army, sent a delegate who actually infiltrated the all the guards and the house arrest around Abbasi Madani, who's the leader of the FIS, and went there and told him, if this continued, the FIS will be buried forever. So this is unsustainable and uncontrollable. So if you want, you might want to declare a ceasefire right now and ask everybody to put down arms. And this did not happen. And one of the reasons for Mizraq actions later on, he basically said the leaders of the FIS did not rise up to the level of the crisis and were acting as if they are captives of the GIA. And by that he meant basically we're losing all support. Whatever is there, we're losing it because of the actions of another organization, and we need to save ourselves at this point if we want this Islamic project to be supportive anymore. But still, I mean, 1995, in the middle of the civil war as well, Mahfouz Nahnah came second in the presidential elections, the Muslim Brothers candidate, after the regime's candidate, General Zerwell. So, you know, there is obviously public support for these groups. It's not like it's all dead, but there is definitely a struggle for public opinion here. The overwhelming majority in Algeria voted for accepting reconciliation in the referendum. So they are welcoming non-violent militants to come back, obviously. But there is also actions against them by people in the or societal actors. Some of the leaders were of the AIS were actually attacked by guns in the streets and so on. So it's like any reconciliation process. There is always the supporters and the ones who are anti. But so far, the supporters seems to be the majority. The root causes, obviously, it's a million-dollar question. Lack of democratization and repressive authoritarianism is one of the major reasons. Jihadism and takfirism were born in Egyptian prisons for a reason. They didn't come out of nowhere. Most of the senior commanders in Al-Qaeda are Egyptians also for a reason. There was a constant failure for most of these authoritarian regimes to accommodate their opposition in a constructive way and diverge their violent tendencies. And this is, I guess, this is what happened in Algeria. This is what happened in Libya. The future of the process, actually, thank you for this because you gave me a chance to go through the last slide. What is this? Basically, in Egypt, what's going on, there is a problem with all right, I think it was lost. Well, anyway, I'll get it over from my head. In Egypt, there is a socio-economic problem now because a lot of the state basically, or the judiciary, issued compensations for those militants or suspected militants who were administratively detained and tortured for a long time, and the state does not have the resources to pay the compensations, which was or does not want to pay the compensations. So you have all these formerly affiliates with the IG who were detained in their teenage years or early 20s, and now they're in the mid-30s with no employment prospects, with no educational certificates, with no money. All what they know is what they learned in the prison, and they're now out on the street, and good luck dealing with them. And something else happening also with the Muslim Brothers, the younger generation of the brothers who are, we're talking, when we talk about the IG, we're talking in the thousands. In the case of the Muslim Brothers, we're talking about tens of thousands. And you have all these younger generations who are quite angry because of the constant repression, at the same time with no avenue to vent out these repression. And they're, so far they're listening to the leadership, which is anti-violence, but they can also hear the Salafi jihadist methods and message via the internet and via other forms of media, and they can react to it if the conditions are ready for this. We have a very same problem. I can go at length about that in Algeria. Lots of complaints from the heads of the militants recently. 2009, Madani Mirzakh just said Bouteflika betrayed us. He told us about reconciliation. We don't have really reconciliation right now. So it's nothing like, you know, Truth Commission, Truth and Reconciliation Commission in South Africa and the proper reintegration process. Nothing at that level so far. But it's a panacea. It's a short-term solution, not a long-term one. Turkey. Of course. But what I feel that, you know, what the Islamists in Turkey did in general is that they removed the missionary activities and focused only on the political activities, and therefore got religion out of the equation. And I think this is the problem with most of the Islamists in North Africa. They can keep religion as, you know, as a guide or a symbol for spiritual reawakening, but once they involve it in politics, you end up with the problems that we have in Egypt, Algeria, and Libya, and others. But they have a lot, obviously, to learn from the Turkic Islamists. But I still think that the most successful thing that the Turkish Islamists did is to put religion aside for a while, and they claim to do so. So,
On the public opinion, definitely, that's something we're very concerned about. As a matter of fact, we look very carefully at that when we're thinking about what we need to do next. And that shapes our thinking. One area we're very concerned about is something that you touched on. What happens to prisoners after their release, especially the youth? That's one program that we're trying to work very closely with the State Department on. Public opinion shapes everything, especially if the public is not happy with the government, they see an association with the United States, it plays a huge role. That goes back and forth, that sways back and forth, but rest assured, this is the track that we're now, the approach that we're taking is how, what's the public one saying, which direction are the radicals taking, how are they feeding off of this. In Algeria, it's a classic case where you have a back and forth between the Algerian government and AQIM in swaying the public. Because at one point, AQIM was having issues recruiting. I don't know if anybody's looked at, in the last year, the threats that the attacks that they've conducted. You have people who are terminally ill now being recruited to conduct attacks. You have elderly. You have people outside of Algeria that are conducting attacks. How is this happening, and how are they convincing these people to do so? So obviously, public opinion does play a role. Sir, for your question, I'll just keep it very brief. Actually, I wanted to show, I failed to show all my slides, but let me see here. This is, again, boiled down into just, those are stated goals, and those are stated goals by senior AQ members. These goals are being carried out. They're being carried out continuously, in, as we see, in North Africa and the Horn. Since we're focused on North Africa, oil-producing countries like Libya and Algeria are prime targets. Sudan is an oil-producing country, but we won't talk about that. Going after peacekeepers is also a prime target, trying to destabilize those areas that are constantly mentioned. Those are the same group of people that fought in Afghanistan, that fought in Iraq. These are the people that we're dealing with in North Africa. So the quick answer to your question is yes, I do believe it's AQ.
Thanks. Let's take another group. We'll start here in the front, sir. There's a microphone coming.
I can talk loud.
I'd like to follow up on the question of public relations or public information that Dr. Saad asked about. When I read about this program, de-radicalization or counter-radicalization, I was thinking primarily of any private or government or citizens' movement to counter violence, some non-violent group or entity to really advocate and to convince the public that jihad is not violence. Jihad is the bigger jihad is not using force. So I'd like to see what's happening in terms of building a local group to counter the terrorists.
All the way in the back, Leanne. Yeah, let's start with Leanne and then.
Thank you. Leanne Kennedy Boudali, RAND Corporation. I have two questions, both for Mr. Ashour. One is whether you could talk a little bit about the relative importance of third parties, particularly in the ideological component of de-radicalization, whether or not it's been important for the state to identify imams, clerics, or social community leaders, people of that sort who played a role in the process, and if so, how they've done that. And secondly, if you have found in your research, if there's a way of predicting which type of de-radicalization is most effective for certain groups. For example, I would assume comprehensive is ideal. But if that can't be the case, would you say there's a way to determine whether pragmatic or substantive de-radicalization is a suitable strategy? Thank you.
Thanks. And then right behind, sir.
Thank you. Mike Pevsner, Senate Intelligence Committee. I wonder if you could just talk very briefly about the internal group dynamics, because, for example, al-Jihad, certainly part of it is you can't talk about it without talking about al-Qaeda. They're so integrated into the al-Qaeda leadership. On the other hand, you've had a substantial number of jihad members that have been split off. Some would argue successfully by the Egyptian government. On the other hand, you have the GSPC signing on to the al-Qaeda brand, probably for recruitment. But how comprehensive is that? And are there elements that can be broken off? So the internal dynamics within these groups, and how beholden are they to the al-Qaeda ideology as opposed to those that can be broken off? Thank you.
Thank you very much. Omar, what's that?
I just make a fussy academic distinction. De-rad is different from counter-rad. De-radicalization is usually about people who took up arms and were violent at one point and then decided to abandon violence on behavioral and ideological levels. Whereas counter-rad, you attempt to deal with this problem before it actually happens. Before they become violent and take up arms, you're trying to take away the legitimacy and divert this type of behavior into a more constructive behavior. There are various in Egypt. I mean, Al-Azhar has been for a long time doing a role in counter-radicalization, but Al-Azhar, since it's a state-sponsored institution, official institution, needs a change in its rhetoric and to approach younger generations. It's not doing that that effectively, I would say. There are other groups which are in opposition, not associated with the regime, having a problem with the government, like the brothers, for example, who were nonviolent officially and have been, you know, calling for nonviolence. But at the same time, they're a political group, so they expect to have gains from these calls. So. Other societal groups, mostly the seculars, but they're not, unfortunately, they don't have a lot of following in Egypt and in Algeria and other places. They are the minority groups, but they will be opposed to violence in general and to religio-political violence in particular. So, imams and ideological direct. Yeah, usually. Obviously, they play a very good role. We have in the UK a program where all those imams that are not affiliated with a specific organization would go to prisons and talk to convicted militants or convicted terrorists, and it's part of a fully fledged prevention program that includes counter radicalization as well as de-radicalization. The most effective way, though, if it came from within the organization, and I'm unhappy to say this, but I've made a profile for leaders that are have quite an impact on de-radicalization, and usually the four main elements is that they are perceived as pious and credible, theologically knowledgeable. This like entails a lot of factors, but whether they're perceived as theologically knowledgeable or they have actually a degree, and having a history of struggle, if you wish, so some blood on their hands. Usually they are quite successful when they start a process. And if you looked at the IG, you know, the way that they were portraying this, that you cannot outbid us in violence. We did it all before. We massacred 129 officers and soldiers in Assyut back in 1981, and we assassinated the president. So we did this, and now we're saying this does not work, and this is Islamically illegitimate. So when it comes usually from within the spiritual, between quotation, or historical leadership of a particular organization, it becomes more efficient in this sense. Was there, the one on al-jihad, yes. There is a lot of internal dynamics within al-jihad in prison and outside of prison, because, as you know, there are some elements who are in Europe and others are in Afghanistan, although they are more affiliated with al-Qaeda now. What happened is when in 97, when the IG declared its DIRAD process, some of al-jihad leaders, mid-ranking leaders, accepted the process, but the majority did not. They failed to convince the others, as well as the grassroots. When Sayyid Imam came in and declared his process in 2007, there was a lot of support from the state. They made him talk to the media. They sponsored a tour for Egyptian prisons by him to attempt to convince the grassroots. And there was debate within all type of questions were thrown in that debate, from why are you saying this now? It's because you're imprisoned. To, by the way, my cousin just died in this confrontation. Is he in heaven or in hell? So all type of questions. However, he failed to convince everybody, mainly because there are senior commanders in al-Jihad who refuse this inside prison, and they see themselves affiliated more with al-Qaeda and with Ayman al-Zawahiri and with the people, and see this is basically a betrayal. The whole de-radicalization process. So, the GSPC. What happened with the GSPC? It's actually only a faction that became the AQM. It's not the whole organization. The whole organization, when it started in 1998, it wanted to distance itself. It said, "Listen, the GIA is completely tarnished now. Public opinion-wise, this became basically a criminal organization." And we need to give ourselves another name, because before that they named themselves GIA Second Zone, because this is where they come from, Second Zone, east of Algiers. And then after that they said, okay, just lose the name, and we'll call ourselves the Salafi Group for Preaching and Combat. When they did so, the aim was to target only military personnel and security personnel and no civilians, and continue the jihad, between quotations. By 2004 or 2003, there was a struggle on the leadership of the organization. Hassan Hattab, the founder and the second emir, was marginalized, mainly because he was thinking about de-radicalization. He was successful in taking with him tens, not hundreds and not thousands, whereas the rest stayed in the organization. And some by later on became the 2007 became the AQIM. Khattab, however, is still trying to take away the legitimacy and trying to say that I never resigned. I was just marginalized, and I'm the legitimate leader of the organization. And I'm telling you now to put down arms. And this has been going on as recent as last month, you know, from the evidence we have. So this is it's a struggle on the legitimacy of violence or nonviolence. Obviously, some of the statements of already de-radicalized militants are not encouraging, because you had in 2005 you had somebody like Ali bin Hajar, one of the leaders of the LID, the Ligue Islamique du Dawa and Jihad, Pour le Dawa et le Jihad. He came in 2005 and told everybody, all you militants up there in the mountains, just keep your positions and arms and men, because it's not that green on this side of the picture. We did not get our pensions. We're not re-employed. We cannot even vote. We cannot form a political party. So all the promises that were given to us in 2004 during Bouteflika's second elections were thrown away. So stay there. And he gets coded, obviously. Bouteflika in 2005 tried to counter this by going into a stadium, gathering all these de-radicalized militants, and apologizing three times to them, and saying that we will deal with all these issues. But obviously, the dynamics are still going on, and so far the majority obviously are with the AQIM.
Thank you. I think that last point highlights, you know, how absolutely resource intensive some of these programs are. I mean, not just financially, but state capacity and other things. I think this issue has been is so incredibly important, and I have so many questions I'd love to ask, but we're quickly running out of time. I think it's really important because we know so much about the radicalization process. There's so much research done on why people become violent, but there's very little comparative research done on why people leave violence or why Islamist or any kind of violent movement stop using violence. You know, I think Omar's great contribution is that, you know, he's providing systemic research, kind of evidence-field-based research, that really helps us explain some of the questions that, as policy, what makes different programs or processes work in different places. Omar has a new book out, The De-Radicalization of Jihadists, Transforming Armed Islamist Movements, which I'm still waiting for my copy in the mail. But please join me in thanking our speakers.